right. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Senate Workforce Committee. Today is February 6, 2018. I call to order the first meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. First, we're going to have an organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting committee rules. There are no changes to the 2017 session committee rules, and the membership of this committee has not changed. So we don't need to really spend a lot of time, I don't think, on that issue. So I'm going to go ahead and ask for a motion, please.
Chair Taylor, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules as presented.
Vice Chair Knope moves to adopt the proposed committee rules as presented. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. I'm going to go ahead and close the organizational meeting and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1566. This has to do with PERS. Ah, see how excited everyone is? It's really exciting, yes. And so I'm going to have a gavel on that. And then I'm going to ask Deborah to summarize the bill. Everyone pay attention, because this is, we're going to be making some history here, hopefully. So let's go here and hear about the Senate bill, the governor's Senate bill.
Senate Bill 1566 was pre-session filed at the request of Governor Kate Brown. It addresses the unfunded actuarial liability of the Public Employment Retirement System, PERS, by creating an employer incentive fund to match portions of side accounts of participating public employers' contributions to PERS and directing funds from multiple sources to the side accounts of school districts, community colleges, and public universities. The sources of funds for direction to side accounts include proceeds from a tax amnesty program of limited duration, excess proceeds of state debt collection, excess proceeds of capital gains taxes and estate taxes, excess proceeds of marijuana tax and wine, cider, and malt beverage privilege tax, excess state lottery fund revenues above estimates after payment of constitutionally required distributions from the fund, non-dedicated proceeds of the settlements from lawsuits in which the state is a party, and a portion of proceeds from the sale of certain unclaimed property to which the state has not taken title for distribution through the Common School Fund. The measure also directs state treasurer to study the option of borrowing monies from the short-term fund for reinvestment to generate excess proceeds for transfer to the PERS fund, provides direct review by the Supreme Court, and takes effect the 91st day after adjournment sine die. The bill has a -1 amendment. The amendment clarifies that the employer incentive fund limits applications for first 180 days to employers whose unfunded actuarial liability is more than 200% of payroll for PERS members, and then opens to all participating public members. It moves the date relating to the tax amnesty program forward 1 year and clarifies that eligibility for taxpayers who have filed bankruptcy protection is limited to open cases. It changes the years for calculating proceeds from debt collection to 2019, 2021, and 2023, and adds language that calculations of proceeds from debt collection exclude some types of debts. It changes the comparisons for calculations of proceeds from capital gains tax and estate tax to determine the growth trend and annual tax liability during the previous 10 tax years and compares to recent tax liability. It changes the years for calculating the proceeds from marijuana tax and from wine, cider, and malt beverage privilege tax to the three biennia between 2017 and 2023. It reduces the amount of excess proceeds from the marijuana tax to be transferred to side accounts by subtracting 20% of actual revenues required to be transferred to cities and counties. It clarifies that unclaimed prizes are included in calculations of proceeds from lottery revenues. It replaces sections concerning proceeds from unclaimed property, provides for certain proceeds from unclaimed property to be segregated within the Common School Fund and distributed to a side account for schools, depending on the claim rate for unclaimed property. It transfers some proceeds of unclaimed property revolving fund to pay claims if the claim rate rises above a certain threshold, and it provides that the state is not obligated to pay claims for unclaimed property from general fund or sources other than monies appropriated or made available by the Legislative Assembly.
Okay. So we will be having soon the distinct honor of having our governor, Governor Brown, come and testify on the bill, along with Alana Pirtle-Ginney. They are not quite here yet. I told them to please come as soon as they can. So we'll go ahead and we will pause on this. I think I'll go ahead and open up another public hearing at the same time on 1534, and we can move forward with that, with the understanding that obviously, when our governor arrives, we'll allow her to testify. So, hope, assume, unless, oh, nope, It's not her. That's it's a lot of pressure coming in. You know? So we're expecting the governor. So I thought, you know, yeah. All right. So let's go ahead, and I'm going to open up at the same time a public hearing on Senate Bill 1534, and Deborah will go ahead and summarize that bill. And again, be patient, everybody, and I may be interrupting you.
May I ask a quick question?
Sure.
I understand we're being filmed and everything. I was just wondering if I could put my phone here. Would that be all right?
Well, you know,
probably not.
The last time I checked, it's the United States of America, and I think that. You know, I think you get to do that. I don't think I can stop that. We have to consult with our constitutional expert here. Is he allowed to put his phone with the U of O symbol on it?
I am not aware of any rule that prohibits it.
Yeah, I don't know that I really feel like I can do that. But
all right,
nice
well,
plug, though. The Oregon State people now are not feeling so good. So, all right, so let's go ahead and hear about Senate Bill 1534. I'm pretty sure I did this, but for good measure.
Senate Bill 1534 was pre-session filed at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. It directs the Department of Human Services to collaborate with the Home Care Commission to establish minimum training standards for home care workers and personal support workers. It requires the department to provide training. It specifies that training opportunities must be tailored to different types of workers, geographically accessible in all areas of the state, and culturally appropriate for workers of all language abilities. It directs the department and commission to maximize federal funding available to pay for training. This bill has a -1 amendment. The amendment clarifies that specific training topics listed in the measure are neither mandatory nor exclusive. It adds the requirement that the department strive to align training requirements with those for care providers in other long-term care settings. It adds an operative date of January 1st, 2020, and adds requirement that the commission and department complete all steps necessary to carry out the provisions relating to the training standards and opportunities by the operative date. And it extends the repeal date to December 2020 for the section that requires the commission to maximize federal funding to pay for training.
Okay, thank you. Let's go ahead, and we have six people that are going to come up and testify. So let's have Dee Carter and Bob Jundeff come up, please. And if Angie Albee wants to join them, that's fine as well. But is Bob here? No. Okay. Okay. Thanks. All right. So Dee Carter, would you like to start us off,
yes,
please?
Well, good afternoon. My name is Nanette D. Carter Joffrey. D's an initial. And I am a home care worker and personal support worker and a member of SEIU Local 503. And my purpose in coming is to make you all aware that as a worker in my employer's home, and these are individuals that are elderly and disabled, it is imperative that we all have the same level of knowledge and to be recognized as part of the healthcare team. And so the ability to have a standard of training that is available to all of us would just increase our professionalism and allow us to be recognized throughout the state as valued members of the healthcare team, and to assure our employers that they have someone that has a level of competency that can ensure that they will receive quality care. So there's the checks and balances that I feel are very beneficial. My background is a little bit different in that I am also a certified nursing assistant. So as a CNA, I already have certain credentials, but a lot of my counterparts don't. And so it's just imperative that that opportunity be afforded them and that we all join in supporting those in the healthcare field to rise up to a level of professionalism that we expect.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and ask everybody to, we're going to take a little break now. We have our governor here, and she's going to come up. We're going to go back to the PERS bill, 1566, and then I'll call you back up. Thank you very much, Ms. Carter, for your testimony. And so, Governor Brown. Lana.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming. We have two hearings open, so we're going to go back to Senate Bill 1566. And Deborah Marinoff, our committee staff here, has already summarized the bill for everybody. And I wanted to also let you know that we are being filmed in addition by the Harvard Kennedy School is here, the business school. They are doing a case law examination of the equal pay bill.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, okay. And so they are here getting...
Of which
you
yourself
signed.
And Senator Knope are starring members of that.
And, of course,
film.
That you supported and and signed. But I wanted to give you some context, but they're here doing some filming for that. So this is what's happening. So you were not caught off guard.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you today. For the record, I'm Oregon Governor Kate Brown. Thank you for your commitment to making the PERS system more sustainable. We must keep the debt we owe from hobbling our public education system. And your work last session on PERS was a great step. Your comprehensive review of so many proposals has allowed us to have a more informed and productive conversation. So thank you for that. As you all know, half of PERS rates, 16% of payroll, is due to the unfunded actuarial liability of Tier 1 and Tier 2 PERS members. In fact, OPSERP's rates, even with the OPSERP's UAL, would be below 10% of payroll. Over two-thirds of the Tier 1 and Tier 2 UAL, unfunded actuarial liability, is from retirees. No matter what, we must pay the Tier 1 and Tier 2 UAL that's driving employer rates. So last year, I pulled together a task force to craft some creative, innovative ways to pay this liability. After hearing from them and reading their report, which I hope you've had an opportunity to do, we were able to craft legislation that reflects the dynamic thinking of that particular group. There are a few things we must do better in order to uphold the promises that we made to retirees while still maintaining critical services for Oregonians across the state. First, I truly believe that we must help our schools. Schools have very little flexibility in their budgets. A legislator recently told me that he thought even saving 2% of payroll in the next biennium's employer increases could lead to more than 20 more teaching positions in the school district he represents. We should do this by committing to put one-time revenues, underutilized resources, and unexpected revenues toward side accounts for education. Second, we have to encourage every single PERS employer to put any extra dollar they have toward the PERS UAL and get their extra reserves into the system so that we have a better idea of the extent of the deficit. I am fully aware that none of this will be an easy task, but it's also not easy for schools to balance budgets when their employer rates go up by 4 to 6% of payroll. And it's not easy, as many public employers have quietly told me over the last several months, to hire the best and the brightest without a competitive compensation system. So what I'm asking of you in Senate Bill 1566 is not easy, but I believe it's a necessary step to address the rising rates employers are trying to pay over the next few biennia. I appreciate the support of your chair and your vice chair. I hope that all of the committee members will join your chair and your vice chair in supporting the bill. And I'm happy to let Lana Pirtle-Guinea go over the details and the amendment that we brought forward today. Thank you, and I'm very happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Governor Brown. Are there any questions? Well, I think the bill is really quite clear. There was with the amendment. And especially if you compare it with the task force report and then you look at the bill with the dash one amendment, it's pretty clear how we got to where we're at. So obviously we'll be having an additional hearing about it, but I appreciate you taking the time to come and to see us and to testify. And I'm sure you have other things you want to be doing.
Thank you.
Than sitting here, but does anybody have anything, any questions? Okay, oh yes.
I just want to thank you for coming as the chair did. That means a lot.
Thank you. You're welcome. I was actually upstairs waiting. It was Alana was with one of your members and having a very in-depth conversation, so I wanted to wait for her to come join me. So thank you all.
All right. Thank you. You want to go ahead or?
Sure.
It's up to you. Okay.
All right. I'm happy to go ahead unless you need to get back to the other
member. No, it's fine. I didn't know if you had another commitment.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ilana Pertle-Guinney. I am the governor's labor and workforce policy advisor. As you heard from the governor, Senate Bill 1566 is one of her priorities this session. We are bringing this bill forward to attempt to find new ways to begin to pay down the PERS unfunded actuarial liability, mainly through the use of side accounts to help offset employer rates moving forward. During the legislative days, we went over the bulk of the concepts in the bill. So what I'd like to do, if you'd allow, is to start by talking about some of the details of those concepts and the new things put forward in the amendment that you all should have available to you today.
Please.
With the amendment, the dash ones to Senate Bill 1566, we are not changing any of the concepts in the bill. We are changing a number of the ways that we talk about or that we get at the dollars that I presented to you all during legislative days. So the main sections of the bill that have changed are the capital gains and estate taxes section and the unclaimed property sections of the bill. I'd like to start with those. They're some of the more complicated pieces, and then talk about some of the other pieces as well. On capital gains and estate taxes, as we modeled the original formula that was in the bill, we realized that what we were capturing was actually the year after a down year. What we had intended to capture, what we had described to your committee during ledge days, was capturing an upside year, those years when we have significant increases in revenue from those two revenue sources. We asked our Office of Economic Analysis and our CFO's office to do some additional modeling to figure out a better way to capture those up years. And what we have in the Dash One amendment is a formula that looks at a 10-year growth trend for those revenue sources and then projects out that growth trend for another biennium and says that in years when the actual revenue received is higher than that growth trend projected out into the next biennium, that those are the years when dollars will go into the side account for PERS, or the side account for K-12 school districts within PERS, excuse me. The other piece of the bill that changed significantly from the original bill to the dash ones is the unclaimed property portion of the bill. We are creating additional safeguards to ensure that there is always money available within the unclaimed property account to pay out claims for property. So in the new version, in the dash ones, we are looking at 35% of reported unclaimed property, which is that original number we had talked about up to 2013. And then for the newer unclaimed property, we are looking at 25% of reported unclaimed property going, instead of directly to PERS, to a separate account within the Department of State Lands held alongside the unclaimed property account, and transferring over four transfers those dollars into a side account within PERS. What this does is allows us before each transfer to reevaluate the claim rate at the Department of State Lands and ensure that that claim rate has not increased. As I reported to you all in January, our average claim rate for unclaimed property is below 50%. Our peak years have been, I believe, 57 and 58%. Claims have never crossed 60%. So we are leaving a buffer there, but if claim rates begin to increase, we'll have the opportunity at the beginning of each biennium to put some amount of money back into the unclaimed property fund to ensure that we can always meet our obligations. That also ensures that we are four biennia out with four bienniums worth of full reported unclaimed property back into that fund before all of the dollars are transferred over to PERS. It extends the timeline a little bit. It means those dollars aren't earning interest within the PERS system immediately. So there is a small decrease in the benefit that we'll see for K-12 schools. We believe that increase will be incremental. We are working on the numbers right now, and it will provide extra assurances that we will always have the dollars available to pay out claims for unclaimed property. Those are the three main changes in the bill. There are a few other technical changes. There were some clarifications needed. We realized that the original bill in the employer incentive fund section specified that for the first 6 months after that fund is capitalized, again, that's the fund that provides 25 cents match on the dollar for new deposits into side accounts made by any public employer. We had specified that for the first 6 months, those funds would be available to employers whose liability was over 200% of their payroll, those who have the largest liability in relation to their payroll. The intent was that after 6 months, that fund would be open to all employers, but that wasn't specified in the bill, so there were some questions about it. There are a few other changes like that that are listed in the Dash One amendment. We were also asked during legislative days what the impact of all of these various funding sources would be, and we have a little bit more information there. I want to be very clear, as I was in January, that most of these formulas are projections. We don't know what the total amount of revenue is that they will bring into a side account for our schools within PERS. But we can look backwards at what would have occurred had these measures been in place 5 or 10 years ago, and we can look at what occurred the last time some of these actions were taken. Using those formulas, we are looking at, depending on which formula we use for a few pieces of the bill, we're looking at somewhere around $400 or $500 million that would be going into this side account for K-12 schools within the PERS system. That amount of money, depending on the amortization period, we believe will lead to a decrease in PERS employer rates for K-12 schools of about 2% of payroll. So another way to think of that is if in 21-23 schools are facing a 6% of payroll increase in costs, we could cut that back down to 4%. That doesn't sound like a huge difference. That doesn't sound like a lot of help. As the governor said in her testimony, one of your colleagues in the House the other day did a little bit of back of the napkin math and reported to us that that would lead to 20 teaching positions, either new teaching positions or teaching positions not cut in his school district. We're working with ODE to try to get numbers like that for either statewide or for every district. I'm not sure if they can do it district by district or if it needs to be statewide numbers, but this will have a measurable impact on our school's ability to keep teachers in classrooms. I want to speak briefly to the two other portions of the bill, three other portions of the bill, just as a refresher on what is in here for you all. The first is that employer incentive fund that I mentioned. This is the fund through which we will provide matching dollars to any employer, any PERS employer who puts money into a side account. As we've mentioned previously, the PERS board has taken actions to make side accounts more accessible. So our belief, our hope is that more and more employers will be able to take advantage of side accounts. This will make that easier for a number of employers by providing a 25 cents on the dollar match. In the bill, that fund is not currently capitalized. The task force, the governor's PERS UAL task force, was looking at a number of potential funding mechanisms which would have brought in $300 to $400 million. Any revenue source that we could have brought forward to you all today at that level would have been difficult for a 6-week legislative session, but we felt it was important to signal to employers that we are moving forward with this concept so that they can start looking at their revenue sources and figuring out how they might be able to find dollars to put toward that side account. We've already heard from a number of employers that they've started that work, so we believe that passing this fund this session is incredibly important to keep that movement. And we look forward to working with you all and your colleagues to capitalize that fund moving forward from this legislative session. We then have the portion of the bill related to side accounts for our K-12 schools. Following that portion of the bill is a note that increases in lottery revenue will go not just to K-12 schools, as the other portions of the bill will, but will be split between our K-12 community, our community colleges, and our universities. The final substantive portion of the bill directs the treasurer's office to complete a study on the feasibility and practicability of moving forward with a tool used by a number of other states who looked at their short-term accounts, that very safe, low-interest rate investment tool, and reinvested some of the funds in their short-term accounts in more aggressive accounts that earned a higher interest rate. The difference in interest earned there could then be deposited directly into the Benefits in Force Reserve, which is the account within PERS that pays out benefits and therefore would have a direct impact on the unfunded liability for all employers within the system. We recognize that this is a difficult week to be talking about a measure like that. This doesn't direct the treasurer's account to take that action. It directs them to study the feasibility of it, look at the experiences in other states, and determine whether or not that would be an action to move forward on in the future in Oregon. With that, I'm actually going to stop so that any questions you all have, we have time to answer.
Okay, Senator Hanson.
Thank you very much. One question I had: when you said there would raise 400 to 500 million, is that a one-time raising or is it ongoing annually as these accounts secure surpluses?
That is a total, or Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, excuse me. That is a total amount. We are looking at revenue sources that would be redirected to the side account within PERS for K-12 schools over, for the most part, it varies by revenue source, but over, for the most part, a three biennium period. After that time, those revenues would go back into either the general fund or the other pots that they had originally flowed into. So over that period of time, as that side account is being capitalized, that's the total amount that we would expect to see.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So just one second, Alana. So for the school districts, mm-hmm. everyone will all school districts benefit from this? And how will it be decided about the allocations and all that? If you could just go into that a little bit more, please.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, the side account that we are proposing in Senate Bill 1566 would be a side account on a particular fund within the PERS system, the Tier 1, Tier 2 pooled account for school districts. Under the Tier 1 and Tier 2 systems, all school districts were pooled into a single, they had a single pool. We have a number of pools within the PERS system, and there was a single pool for all K-12 schools. By aligning the side account with that pool, what we do is affect all school districts and affect all school districts essentially proportionally based on their payroll costs. So districts with a larger payroll receive a larger benefit, districts with a smaller payroll a smaller benefit, but proportionally they are all receiving an equal benefit based on the size of their payroll.
Okay, so schools, districts that are, for lack of a better term, better off than other school districts, how will we make certain that the treatment is equal?
The treatment would be based on payroll, so it would not be based on revenue coming into the district necessarily. It would not, the only connection there would be districts that have a larger versus a smaller payroll, which of course can be affected by district size, by revenue, by a number of issues. Most things within PERS are determined based on payroll. The unfunded liability is distributed, if you will, based on payroll within each of the PERS employers. So what we're talking about is creating as close alignment as we can between the benefit from this side account and the portion of the actuarial, unfunded actuarial liability, the portion of the payments coming into the system for each of those school districts.
Okay, I just wanted to get that clarified because I think people will have questions about that. Yeah, go ahead, Senator Sanderson.
So Portland Public Schools has the largest payroll, correct? And then Salem-Keizer has the second largest. They're the second largest.
Chair Taylor, Senator Montes-Anderson, I'm not sure of the exact ranking, but I know those are both among the highest payroll schools.
And I was just curious, of the money then, does that mean 40% of it is going to be going to those? They deserve it. It's equitable, but I was just curious as to the amount that would be going to Portland Public Schools. I mean, do you have it broken down?
Chair Taylor, Senator Montes-Anderson, we do have a breakdown of payroll costs for each PERS employer that their PERS costs are associated with, and I'm happy to get you that information. I don't know it off the top of my head because it's 700 lines long, but we can get that to you.
It'd be curious, follow up, it'd be curious, you know,
schools in my district just where they fall in the line and share that with them, or maybe you've already shared it with them.
Chair Taylor, Senator Mona Sanderson, we haven't shared the full list, although it is publicly available on PERS's website. The distribution by percent of payroll, as you said, Senator Mona Sanderson, provides an equitable or a proportional distribution across all employers, which is why we are looking at tying this to an education account specifically and then distributing it in that way that PERS distributes most costs.
Okay. Anything else? All right. Thank you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. And no one else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 1566. I'd like to have that go down definitely in the history books that we had a PERS bill and no one signed up to testify. I mean, that's pretty significant. So, all right, so let's go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1566. And then we will continue with public hearing Senate Bill 1534. So thank you, Ms. Carter, for testifying. We'll go ahead and bring Bob and Angie back up. Thank you for being patient. Sorry about that. Are you going to go ahead? Okay, go ahead.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angie Albee, and I am the legislative liaison for the Aging and People with Disabilities Program and the Office of Developmental Disability Services at DHS. Also, for the record, DHS supports the passage of Senate Bill 1534. With over 30,000 home care workers and personal support workers that serve over 25,000 vulnerable Oregonians here in the state, it is critical that we address the professionalization of this really important workforce. This bill does so by requiring DHS and the Home Care Commission to develop training standards. Home care workers and personal support workers provide critical supports and services for our aging population and for those individuals who experience physical, intellectual, and developmental disabilities. Developing a highly skilled, culturally competent, and person-centered workforce requires an investment in training opportunities that will enhance the safety, stability, and quality of life for those we serve. Also, over the next decade, our aging population in the state of Oregon will continue to grow. Oregon has historically been a long-term leader and national leader in long-term care because of our commitment to safety, independence, and choice. Without home care workers, our commitment to provide opportunities for individuals to age in place would be impossible. Similarly, in Oregon's intellectual and developmental disability system, without personal support workers, our commitment to self-determination and independence would be very difficult to uphold. Workers provide individuals with access to supports that are critical to the health, safety, and quality of life. So by passing this bill, we're taking a step forward towards investing in higher standards of care for those we serve. And I just wanted to add that we really appreciate at the department, the collaborative work we've done with SEIU on this bill. And we look forward to strengthening this really important workforce together, which we feel is a huge responsibility for the department. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? All right.
Chair Taylor. And it was the PERS thing.
I know, believe me. I feel you. I feel you. I do.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundaff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. And we strongly support Senate Bill 1534. Besides the fact that individuals want in-home services, they want to be able to stay with their homes and in their homes and with their families. Another important factor that Disability Rights Oregon is involved with is legal rights. And one of those legal rights is the Americans with Disabilities Act, and particularly a Supreme Court decision known as Olmstead versus LC, often referred to just as Olmstead, which says that an individual who receives government-funded services has a right to receive them in the most appropriate integrated setting in the community. And so for those people who may want to leave institutional services, be that a nursing home, a psychiatric hospital, or another type of residential facility, and are appropriate to do so, they have a right to do so. And having truly effective, well-trained staff that can provide in-home services, that is a key to their being able to succeed in being at home. And so we think this bill is a great step forward, and we support it.
Okay, great. Any questions? All right, thank you both. Okay, so now we'll have Katie Rose and John Bartholomew and Kendall Mason come up, please. Would you like to start?
I would love to.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Katie Rose, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Support Services Association. We are a group of 14 support services brokerages that cover the state of Oregon, and we serve a little less than 8,000 adults with developmental disabilities who are living in their own or their family homes. And I'm also here as the chair of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. And we're a group of about 30 agencies and individuals who have come together for advocacy for people with developmental disabilities. Thanks for the chance to talk today. I'll be quick. Brokerages began back in 2001, approximately connecting people to services in their homes and communities. At the time, we would connect them to people to do the work for them. A lot of times we would assist them in employing what we called at the time domestic employees. So those would be people who are already in their lives that they wanted to hire to do the support work that they needed for them. There's been a lot of growth in the system since then. There's been a lot of change, and the workforce capacity is exhausted. I think you've heard that before. The Oregon Home Care Commission has a workforce development task force, which I bet you're also familiar with. Much of that is devoted to recruiting effectively personal support workers. There's a big difference between what we started off doing, which was taking people who were already in a person's life, who knew them, who they knew, and hiring them to do work that they were probably familiar with, and what we have to do now, which is find people who are willing to do this work, who are interested in doing this work, who get to know the person and get to know the work. That difference for us is what really drives us to support Senate Bill 1534. We know that there are two components to a successful employment relationship. It's the employer and the employee. And we really feel that having a strong core training curriculum for personal support workers would go a long way to securing the employee side of that equation and ensuring that people with developmental disabilities can live where they choose with the support that they need for many years to come. So thank you for the opportunity to support Senate Bill 1534, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, so it doesn't look like Mr. Bartholomew is here, so go ahead and you wrap it up for us, please.
I would love to wrap this up for you. Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, my name is Kendall Mason. I do work for SEIU. My focus is long-term care policy, and this is an issue that we have been working on for quite some time. This bill didn't arise just a couple months ago. This is a project that we've been working on with stakeholders, including DHS and the commission, for probably about a year now, and I don't want to beat a dead horse. I think it's been clear we've participated in the Thomas P. Miller report, which took place out of Senate Bill 775 from 2015, and that report was given to this committee during legislative days in January. We also participated in the Secretary of State's audit of the Home Care Commission and home care workers, and we have even surveyed our own workforce, our own home care and personal support workers around workforce development and supports needed. And it has just been very clear for the last several years, I think, that home care workers not only need but want access to more training and professionalization of the work. And it's been identified by many third-party entities as well that it's time to start doing this. And it's been a great honor to work with all the stakeholders in this process. And I did want to point to OLIS in general. There's several people who are unable to make it themselves today but have submitted testimonies, including someone from the American Association of University Women who supports this issue very much, as we all know that home care workers are predominantly women that do this work, and it's not a coincidence that they're underpaid. Just want to throw that in there. But there is a Dash One amendment, and that is something that we also worked very closely with DHS and stakeholders on, and I feel that everyone is pretty happy with the Dash One amendment as it is, and just want to wrap that up. Thank you. Great. For the time.
Okay,
I appreciate
any questions?
It.
Yes.
Senator Hansel. Kendall, thank you for coming by my office earlier on in January and kind of filling me in on the details. And for the record here on this hearing, could you explain a little more detail where the funding for this additional training and that aspect is, please?
Yeah, so we have been digging in pretty deep with DHS and the commission to figure out, like, how we can leverage the dollars that we're already investing in training and making sure that we can get this off the ground without some additional funding in the beginning. And so we feel pretty strongly, and DHS also can come up and back me up if they would like to, but they don't have to, that we can get this off the ground with no cost if we are more innovative with the way that we deliver the trainings, if we are leveraging federal dollars as appropriately as we should be, because right now we're not leveraging all the Medicaid match that we could be, and if we just pay more attention to the dollars that we're investing and how effective they're being invested in the current training levels. DHS does say that there will be significant personnel committed to this project, and it will take personnel time to do so, but they won't need any additional personnel to make sure that we can get this off the ground.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So I just wanted to say thank you, Kendall. You've worked really hard on this, and I think you've done a really good job. It's been very thorough, and all the questions I've had have all been answered, and so I want to thank you for your hard work on this, and thank you for coming. Okay, so let's go ahead, and no one else has signed up to testify, so we will go ahead and close a public hearing on Senate Bill 1534, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1546, and this is a very unique, tiny little PERS bill that has to do with one person now, and I don't know how many in the future. So we're going to go ahead and have Deborah explain this. But this is a very unique situation, and I don't want to have this be confused with any of the other PERS bills that are out there. So why don't you go ahead and
explain this. Did you want me to identify the other bill?
If you want to, sure. Okay, so, but not to be confused with. But
okay. Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 1546 is not to be confused with House Bill 4115, which prohibits statewide elected officials, judges, and legislators from becoming PERS members after July 1st, 2018. That is not this bill. This bill was pre-session filed at the request of Chief Justice Ballmer for the Judicial Department. It allows a judge member of the Public Employee Retirement System who was formerly a member of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, OPSERP, to apply the service credit as a judge member towards the hours of service required for vesting in the OPSERP pension program. And it becomes effective the 91st day following adjournment sine die. And this bill has no amendments.
Okay, great. We'll go ahead and ask Bruce Miller to come up, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior counsel to the State Court Administrator here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. Ms. Marinoff has described the bill. It arose this last fall when PERS contacted us and said that one of our judges who had been an OPSERP member was about to lose her OPSERP benefit because of time that she had spent as a member of the judge PERS. So the issue is a vesting anomaly that occurs when someone starts out in OPSERP, is sworn in and as a judge, which automatically puts them into judge PERS. And if they haven't vested in OPSERP, then they lose the OPSERP benefit for no other reason than the fact that they've gone from one section of the PERS statutes to another section of the PERS statute. So we worked with PERS to try to draft some wording to correct this after they contacted us and alerted us to the problem. I think we've gotten there on the drafting. For a little historical context, this was not an issue for Tier 1 and Tier 2 participants because the statute was clearer there that if you went into Judge PERS from Tier 1 or Tier 2 before you'd vested, then your time spent in Judge PERS counted towards vesting. Our goal is to have the same thing occur for folks who are in OPSERP. This will allow us to, or this will prevent the one judge in issue from losing her OPSERP benefit, and it will help us with recruiting or attracting judges who are in OPSERP now who may feel like they don't want to come on because they haven't on the bench because they haven't vested yet.
Okay. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Hensel.
Again, thank you for coming by my office. You said there may, you've heard there might be a few others that you weren't aware of when the bill was drafted that might also be involved in this.
Madam Chair, Senator Hensel, that's right. I've heard anecdotally that there may be a couple others out there. I have not identified them, and I don't believe PERS has either, but we all think it's possible that there are others out there. It would, you know, you'd have to go through and each member and try to find. It will certainly, in my opinion, affect future judges who, you know, if they come in before they vested an officer, then they would not, they would lose their benefit.
But so this bill will follow up, if I may. This bill will take care of any strays out there, if you will, that we don't know about, or anybody in the future. It'll be,
Madam Chair, Senator Hensel, that's right. The way it's drafted, it was intended to capture everyone who is in this dilemma right now. It applies backwards to anyone sitting on the bench effective January 1 of this year going forward. If they haven't retired yet, then they're covered. I think if anyone had retired, they would know that they lost their benefit, and they would have been hollering about it, and we haven't heard from anyone that, gotcha, that lost it, other than the one judge.
You said you believe that PERS is okay and is supporting this. I just, PERS is in the back of the room. A nod of the head would, or not, or are you going to testify later? Or?
Okay, oh, sorry. I didn't see that.
Madam Chair, Senator Hensel, I don't know that PERS can speak for themselves. I don't know that they will take a position on the bill, but we did work with them to try to draft wording that would accomplish what we need to do. So they had input on that. And
excellent. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to go ahead. Thank you, Senator Hensel. Thank you. I'm going to take a wild guess that when Deborah went to go get the witness, the sign-up sheet, the witness sheet, we have, there we go, we have Steve Rudman. I personally am glad to see Mr. Rudman. It feels like an incomplete week here in the Capitol if I don't see my...
We don't see him every day.
I know. I see you.
Thank you.
Thank
for the
you
record,
coming.
Steve Rudman with PERS. If I may address Senator Hansel's question, it leads into the comments I'm going to make, which is to say we are policy advisors to you as a legislature. We are not here in advocacy in either way of the bill, but I think it's important for you to understand the consequences of it. So I want to make two points. One is the first consequence is, as the prior testimony said, this is what used to happen for Tier 1 and Tier 2, and doesn't happen for OPSERP judgment or OPSERP members that go into the judge program. The judge program is a completely different retirement structure. So when an individual moves from one to the next in OPSERP, this bill creates a special advantage for those people that become judge members who come from OPSERP as opposed to any other prior employment. Vesting in a retirement program is on a common qualification. So if they did not vest in whatever their prior employment was and they come into a judge program, only if they came from an OPSERP program would they have this benefit. Every other program, they would have that vesting wear away over time. The crucial difference between Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP is that Tier 1, Tier 2 was an account-based benefit. In other words, members made contributions into their regular or variable account, and that account grew over time to fund their benefit. The challenge with failing to vest in that is you went into what was called loss of membership in Tier 1, Tier 2, which is to say if you went into loss of membership, earnings would no longer be credited to your account. So judges who moved from Tier 1, Tier 2 into the judge member program were in a conundrum because they can't pull their money out of Tier 1, Tier 2, but if they stay on the bench long enough, they would have lost earnings on their money going forward. OPSERP is completely different. We're only talking about the pension benefit in OPSERP. The individual account program contributions are all immediately vested. So employers make contributions to fund the pension. If an individual does not vest in the benefit, then those contributions are spread across the other costs to the other members in the program, meaning that there is a factor that is considered by the actuaries, which is how many people are not going to vest in OPSERP. This creates a way for those contributions to remain with these individuals, I should say, because while there's one that the Judicial Department has identified, this is perpetual, meaning it will affect everyone who comes from OPSERP into the judge program in the future. So y'all know how complicated PERS is. This is adding another complication where we could automate for, let's say, the thousands of people that are in OPSERP that will eventually work their way through to become vested. Now we have to layer in a, but what if they didn't just leave? What if they went into the judicial program? And now we have to do that check for the very few people that will happen to see whether we need to continue to ratchet their contribution or ratchet their vesting to make sure that they vest in the benefit however many years they earned of service credit in OPSERP. And remember, it has to be small. It's only 5 years that you would take to vest in OPSERP. Those are the thoughts I'd like you to consider as you look at and think about whether to move this bill forward. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Yes, Senator Hansel.
If a person is vested in OPSERP and they go into the judge, all of that goes with them.
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, that's correct. So let's say you spent 10 years at the Department of Justice. In OPSERP, you get 10 times 1.5, you get 15% of your final average salary when you eventually reach retirement age. And that's locked in. If you only had 3 years, let's say at the Department of Justice, and went into a judge position, you don't get more than 3 years. So you only get 3 times 1.5, what is that, 4.5% of your final average salary? That is all your OPSERP benefit will be when eventually at the end of your service you retire. You just don't lose that benefit by having moved into the judge program. Uniquely, that person would not lose that benefit.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Roden. All right, so no one else signed up to testify. So we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1546. Our next meeting is going to be on Thursday, the 8th. And is there anything else for the good of the order? And look, we got out early. That's so unlike us. So now you have some time to go and work on other things. So we'll adjourn the meeting.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
My committee completed all of its work today. We passed 4 bills, and we have nothing left to do.
Woo-hoo! Party at McMenamin.
Some of us are just kidding. So I'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting, Senate Committee on Workforce. Thank you.